This is Jeff.
Hey, Jeff. This is Gary Younghand.
Hey, good. Gary, glad that you're able to join us today.
Yeah, me too.
Well, good. Rob is still getting prepared here, and usually we have a number of other folks that call in at different intervals, and so, well, good. You guys having a great day in Taos area?
Yeah, it's lovely up here. Yeah, sitting outside for the call, so that's a bonus.
That's good for you. That's what we're supposed to do when we have beautiful places like that, huh? Yeah. Yeah, same thing here. It's been just terrific. And how's Willie Nelson?
He's doing good. We just went for a good long hike up the hill, so he's crashed out here next to me.
Uh-huh. Nice. Yeah, I enjoyed seeing him. That was really good. Oh, I know. I've been meaning to send you an email because every once in a while in the Santa Fe newspaper, there's a notice of the Michael Hearn music event, and it's...
it's up in Tuskegee Valley this year, yeah.
Yeah, a barn dance, that's what it's called. I was trying to remember what it was called, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if we'll make it this year, but it's always pretty neat.
Yeah, I think they used to have that out at a place called the Old Blinking Light, and that place closed down, so they've moved it up to Taos Ski Valley this year.
Ah, you're right. So, I didn't recognize the spot, so we'll just see.
Yeah.
So that's been, for music-wise, that's been on my mind to just remind you that I keep seeing it listed here in the paper and just...
Yeah, he's one of the local celebrities. I've been wanting to see him along the way sometime.
He's a really, really good player. Yeah.
Hello, everyone. This is Rob Raccoon.
Hey, Rob. We got a few folks here.
Good. It's just about 3:30 and in Santa Fe. Thanks for joining us. We are, as you know, recording this so that people can listen later on, and we'll have a question and answer period. So if you have questions, you can speak up or you can email me, which I'll get during the talk, and try and answer those questions if you are a shy and retiring type of person. I thought that I would just begin with an overview of the markets, the economy, some sort of large long-term trends, and then hopefully that will stimulate some discussion, and we'll take it from there. I try to talk a little bit faster on these so that it's easier for people to listen to later on, so I apologize if I seem to be going a little bit fast. Anyway, let's just begin with the big picture in the economy, which is essentially that the reported numbers are sort of fair, and that's good news. Most people, especially in Europe and Japan, have had bad news for so many quarters now that basically neutral news looks good. And that's the case. Some of the European countries, notably Germany, are showing a turn towards a recovery, an economic recovery. They say that France even is showing some manufacturing strength, which I find hard to believe. But that's what the numbers show. It's probably enough so that people are not worried about a deep depression, but not enough to solve the debt issues that are kind of overhanging both Europe and Japan and of course, the U.S. The issues are that the developed world, U.S., U.K., Japan, Germany, that the average debt level compared to the gross national product is about 100%. That is, our combined debt government agency. This does not include pension obligations, which are huge, but essentially not calculated for these purposes, and that's one problem with the numbers. But the average developed nation's debt level is 100% of GDP, and it's generally thought by economists that 90% is really the sustainable, the upper limit of the sustainable level of debt. So what we have is a huge overhang of public debt, which essentially is an absorption of bank debt from the late 2000s, when the housing market worldwide came to an abrupt halt. And then the combined government spending with lowering taxes but increasing government spending have all served to increase the sort of base level of government debt before even the kind of absorption of the financial industry's debt, so as to ease the public's conscience or worries about the stability of the financial system. So that being said, and I try not to come off as too much of a pessimist, because really by nature I'm an optimistic person, and I think the long-term outlook is good for intelligent investing. But what's happened the past, certainly this year so far, really the last 12 months, is that this public sector debt and the complacency about it has come to the point where and I've said this many times before, that the massive amounts of liquidity provided by this increasing level of public sector debt has gone into the stock market, into the real estate market, and a good amount of it is sitting in cash on the balance sheets of corporations and banks and individuals who are, I think, cautious. There's an old Dutch proverb that goes, in prosperity, caution; in adversity, patience. And I think we're in the financial prosperity phase, since the market has gone up so much, about actually 34% over the last 2 years, of which 7/8 of that gain in the stock market has been due to what we call momentum investing. That is, it's not due to better economic conditions, higher profits, higher productivity on the part of companies, but it's due to just the fact that money has poured in and created multiple expansion. That is price-earnings ratio, which is a little technical, but it's basically new money following old money. It's not due to the increased, economic activity, because even though we're not in a double or triple dip recession, the level of economic activity certainly is substandard. This is the weakest economic recovery since the Depression. And that's borne out in real employment numbers. When you hear about the unemployment rate going down, which has been reported by the government, remember the 6.5% is the targeted unemployment rate at which the Federal Reserve has said they will end their liquidity or bond buying program. We now stand officially at 7.4%. down from, let's say, 8% a year ago, 7.6% last fall. Most of those jobs that have been created that make up the official statistics are fairly low wage paying service sector jobs in the retail, hotel, eating businesses, and many of the jobs, I believe, of the part-time employment workforce has increased over the last 6 or 7 years from 3 million people up to 8 million people. So a lot of people working multiple jobs, a lot of people going from high wage paying jobs to lower wage paying jobs. Certainly, retirement is not in the cards for many people these days, and that hasn't held back the stock market because the liquidity created by the Fed, the central banks around the world, has come into the banks and then into the investment houses, and a rising tide. So the good news is the markets have done well. The cautionary note is that it's primarily liquidity driven, as you saw today in the market. Any good economic news is met by a declining stock market, because the prospects for continued, at least in the U.S., for continued central bank purchasing of bonds, it's a little different than printing money, which is an easier concept to grasp, that the government prints money. That's not exactly what's happening, but it has the same effect of providing more liquidity, their bond purchasing program. And that's the kind of the, like, real estate location, location, location in the market. It's basically Federal Reserve, Federal Reserve, and Federal Reserve. So in my mind, what that really means is that there are investment strategies of branching out to better capitalized, less in debt, more flexible, more entrepreneurial market environments than the developed world, even though the U.S. certainly has outperformed the rest of the world in terms of stock market performance because of the perceived safety of the U.S. and the U.S. dollar, certainly by most economic, real economic performance terms. There are other areas of the world that are more promising. So, in fact, on a macro scale, if one looks at demographics, at the aging of the population, it becomes a very telling sign, with sort of the racehorses stacked up, where Japan is in the worst shape, Europe next, then the U.S., and then surprisingly countries like China, who are just starting to see the long-term effects of their one child per couple policy. The Japanese economy, the Japanese market is up really an amazing amount this year. It's up in local currency terms 32%. The Japanese yen has depreciated, which helps their exporters. So in U.S., for U.S. dollar investors, the market is only up about 18%. That is due entirely to the Japanese central bank doing a 180-degree turn and changing from a tightly controlled, I wouldn't say austerity-based philosophy, but to one where they are flooding their market with bonds, with bond buying programs, with low interest rates, with special considerations to their banks, in the hope that that will generate real growth in Japan. That's all well and good. The markets certainly love that. The Japanese workforce is aging at such a rate that I think in 20 years there'll be 3 retired workers for every 1 person working, which is essentially the reverse numbers of what the experience was from, let's say, 1950 to 2010, where you had a large working population, highly productive, not that many retirees. Obviously, people are living longer. The technology is available to extend people's lives, and so in Japan, that demographic shift is looking to act like a brake on their economy to the tune of 3% of GDP per year. Now, that is a huge amount because a normal healthy economy grows at about 3 to 4%. That's the rate that economies need to grow to generate new jobs to be considered long-term healthy. The U.S. has been growing at 2% or so, a little bit less perhaps the last few years. It's not recessionary, but it's not a sustainable, strong recovery, which is why the Fed hasn't started raising interest rates, because they don't see any need, any real inflationary danger, which is a different question. But Japan has this headwind that they will start to encounter within the next 10 years, and Japan has a huge impact on the rest of the Far East, as does China. And so that is one thing working against Japan's economy. And so we think that their stock market is not necessarily the place to be for the long run. Europe is going to see about a half of that amount of headwind, about 1.5% contraction, just a natural contraction due to the aging of the population over the next decade, and that gets worse as you get into the after 2020. And so Europe is basically looking at structural changes in the basic way that their society operates if they're to regain a firm economic footing, France being probably the biggest and the most glaring example of this. The French tax receipts take up about 40% of their economy, which turn around and means that the French government is responsible for providing energy, healthcare, education. And the assumption in France is that businesses are there in order to support the state. They're not really there to provide returns to stockholders. I'm not much of one to comment on social policy, much to some clients' chagrin, but that's just me personally, and my job is to find where the investment opportunities are with some degree of ethical consideration. Debatable how strong that is, but a different discussion. So I think France is a bellwether for Europe in terms of when do they make it possible for businesses to, let's say, hire and fire people at will. When do they make it possible for landowners, apartment owners, to turn out people if they don't pay their rent, which is very difficult to do. So the French debt and the French government is really the main factor there, and France and Germany being the largest players in Europe, it has a huge effect. So I think watching France, maybe even after Italy and Spain. Italy has a chronic problem with corruption, with low growth, low tax receipts, low compliance with the law. Maybe that will change. It certainly could. Spain is notorious for regional differences. There are regions like provinces in Spain that collect taxes on transporting goods outside of their province, clearly a violation of the EU intent. So Europe is facing, I'd say, much more wrenching changes than the U.S. and Japan, whose society is structured around their kind of racial unanimity and their lack of tolerance for immigration. Is that's what is choking Japan, and the traditional sort of things that Europeans might look at as the reasons for their, in quotes, high quality of life are the things that are probably most going to be most under attack going forward. So the European Central Bank has said that they're going to do whatever it takes to keep interest rates low, which essentially means that it really doesn't matter how successful the Greek government or the Portuguese government or the Cyprus government is in dialing back their spending or in promoting new businesses. The combined European bank will stand behind them by guaranteeing their bonds, by guaranteeing their government's ability to borrow. Even if they can't borrow in the private market, they can borrow from the European Central Bank in the same way that, for example, Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley were allowed and encouraged to borrow from the government back in 2008. When they were way overextended, the government said, we are going to be your guarantor because we don't want to take the risk of what might happen to the economy if you fail, like Lehman Brothers failed and there was the big shakeout and emotional meltdown in the market when that happened. So demographics are a headwind to the developed world. On the other hand, in Indonesia, other places in South America, young population, more workers coming into the workforce, easier to start businesses. So they're places that what I like to call the younger economies are going to have a long-term advantage. They also start with much lower debt levels. The average debt level in the younger economies, we used to call them the emerging economies, I guess most people still do, but the average government debt is 40% of GDP, as opposed to 100% in the U.S., U.K., Japan, Germany. And so they're actually more fiscally sound, many of those countries, than Europe, Japan, and the U.S. So it's not to say that we're taking most of our investment money and moving it to the younger economies, the emerging markets. We're not. What we are doing is buying companies that do a lot of their business in those countries because those markets are expanding, and we look for companies whose revenues and profits are expanding. So the interesting thing, just one more word about Europe and the European Bank, is that you've seen a very big change in the public relations, in the media output from Europe. 6 months ago, a year ago, Germany was playing the hard cop, the bad guy, saying, okay, austerity this, austerity that. There was lots of infighting that was in the news. It made things very difficult for all of those governments, because people were just anxious whether the European Union would stay together. You don't see any of that dissent now. You don't see really any criticism of Greece anymore. It doesn't matter what they do financially. The Germans have learned to play team ball and to, I guess that's different than money ball, but it sounds the same to me. The Germans really need the euro to stay intact. They see that basically it's in their self-interest to keep it together, saving their export economies and their price advantage that they had when the euro was created, giving up the Deutschmark. The Germans really were given a leg up on becoming an exporter. So I think, at least on the face of things, Europe is over that hump. It doesn't mean by any stretch of the imagination that they actually have solved their financial problems. But in the world that we live in, that doesn't seem to matter. Now, it matters to you and me in our personal budgets. It matters to individual companies that have to make it or go out of business. But because the perception is that governments don't go out of business, especially sort of wide area governments like the U.S. or the European Union, given the interconnectedness of the financial system, even Japan or China, that, and we'll come back to China in the question and answer period, but that as long as this kind of liquidity-driven feeling of confidence remains, the markets should go up, the stock market should go up, bond owners earn practically nothing, and everyone goes on hoping that real growth will happen. Now, real growth to me means a job creation and productivity gains. It's very interesting, and this will kind of round out and bring to a temporary close my macro picture here. From an employment view, the U.S. workforce participation, the women now make about 60% of women are now in the workforce versus 40% a couple of decades ago. So the percentage of women in the workforce has increased by 50%, while male participation in the workforce has fallen from 80% down to 71%. And you see this in the kind of changing composition of the workforce. There's still this kind of glass barrier or pay differential in many industries between men and women, but women are becoming more and more of a factor in law, in medicine. I don't know so much about in banking, but certainly in government, they're also more of a factor. So I think the overall economic word is kind of very slow growth, has its good aspect with very muted inflation. The confidence that has been reinstilled in the general public is seen also in the price of gold having fallen off. I believe that is more of a technical issue given the meteoric rise in the price of gold over the last 10 years that basically mathematically it needed to fall back, and it sort of requires a resting place where it is now about 30% off of its high. But overall, investors have been rewarded. People who have been out of the market are not willing to stay in and bear the volatility have seen their yields on cash go down. But that's all very tenuous, and so any good economic news, as we saw today, is rewarded by a fairly big drop in the stock market, a drop in the bond market, treasury yields going up, and so it's going to be a very interesting September, which is typically the month when I say the New York people come back from the Hamptons and go back to work and say, gee, this doesn't look too good, and they tend to take their profits in September. So I'm kind of looking forward to that as an opportunity to buy. So I've gone on for close to 30 minutes here. I apologize if I've been overly boring or whatever. So maybe I will see if there are any questions out there. Hopefully, I haven't put you all to sleep. So, anyone have any questions?
Well, I have a question. You mentioned China earlier. How do you think the current economic state in China is going to affect the global economy in the near future?
Well, a good question. China is very interesting because it's almost impossible to know what goes on there. The government statistics are notorious for being skewed to deliver the political message that the Chinese government wants. What is clear is that the Chinese banks are in much worse shape than Lehman Brothers was when it went bankrupt. And so the need for the Chinese banks to somehow show profits and maintain confidence is something that the government is very concerned about. The slowing in growth in China is clear, that China is not going to be able to grow at 9-10% in the future based on exporting to Europe and America. As Europe has gone into a slow, no-growth kind of environment, that has cut down on the opportunities for the big state-owned Chinese companies to make money. What they have turned to instead is the development of infrastructure. You see cities going up, new railroad lines going up, factories being built. All of this serves well to create short-term employment. Unfortunately, many of the houses and apartments and new cities are places where there are not jobs, and so you have a kind of a huge mismatch between the supply of housing and where it's actually needed. The state-owned enterprises, which really are the mainstay of the Chinese economy, have huge inefficiencies in them. Most of them would close their doors if the shareholders actually knew what was going on. But still, China has, 1.2 billion people who want to buy things, and there is an increasing level of affluence in China among the middle class, and they are becoming concerned about the environmental conditions there. There's an interest in organic food because they realize that up to 20% of the arable land in China is considered polluted way beyond remediation. And as people are more educated and have more money, they get more concerned about the quality of life. And so the Chinese, the young Chinese people are asking questions that the older one, older ones were probably too afraid to ask about. So I think you see a slowing growth in China. It is not going to be the engine that pulls the world economy along. It's very, very interesting to see the new premier who has lived in the United States. You know, the Chinese are hardworking people. They're educated. So I think they turn from a export-driven economy to a domestic-driven economy, which is what they want. Kind of hard to imagine 600 million people driving cars, whether they're electric or not. It apparently takes a couple of hours to commute from one part of the city to another because the roads just weren't built for cars. Their mass transit, which is what they're building, may be an answer to that. So we'll see how the leadership in China adjusts to that. The good news about China is they have huge amounts of capital from their past decade of success in exporting, and they're a very focused economy in that the government and businesses and military and banks all are essentially the same people. So I think they have, that they can solve their issues, but I don't think that they're going to serve as an engine for world growth going forward. Sorry for the long-winded answer there.
What about the Federal Reserve, and what do you anticipate their role will still continue to be, or will they back off a bit?
Okay. Well, there's a lot of discussion about who the next Federal Reserve chairman or chairwoman is going to be. the likelihood of Lawrence Summers being the next chairman, I think, is nil due to his well-deserved status as a pariah among half the population, i.e. women, since he as president of Harvard was so inappropriate and really is seen as a self-promoter. So I think we see Janet Yellen as the next Fed chairperson. She definitely supports a stronger Fed role in the economy. That is, she is not concerned about inflation. She is concerned ultimately about serving the president, serving the to try and get unemployment down, and so continuing to stoke the furnace with credit is what she has pledged herself to, and is likely the way that we're going. That is really a very big positive for the stock market. It's not a negative for the bond market. It means that the inappropriateness of buying new bonds, especially long-term bonds, remains. That strategy that we have taken, which is to not reinvest maturing bond money into 5-10 year bonds, but to stay very short term, because the Fed's policy has worked on the surface for the last 3 or 4 years. She's a proponent of continuing that strategy, and people feel very, very strongly one way or the other that it's a strategy that works great until it doesn't work, and then it's a disaster because all of the pent up inflationary forces that have been created by the propagation of credit and moving money into the banks will come home somehow to roost and hurt the economy. I don't really know. I think we just have to play that card and continue to watch the Fed as everyone does. At some point, the economy does show some signs of strength, and the Fed is called on to reduce its presence. It's like it's become the gorilla in the room, crowding everyone else out, and no one really knows what they're going to do without it. And so the Fed is really the main player in the economy at the time being, and I think that continues. Neither Yellen nor Summers has really any commitment to the traditional role of the Fed guarding the value of money. That was why the Fed was created, was to be an independent watchdog to ensure that the value of the holders of the U.S. dollar were not cheated out of their value because of profligate spending. And that is out the window. And the Fed has become a totally different animal. It has become a implementator of policy, which is low unemployment. And you know, you can't argue with that from a social perspective. Everyone wants a job. Well, most people want jobs, and hopefully there are jobs out. And so it's a very big change in the role of the Fed, and I see that continuing. Anyone with another question?
I was wondering what you thought about gold and about what the future of gold might be.
Okay. Well, as everyone knows, gold has dropped from around 1800 to in the mid 1300s. It was down in the high 1200s. So about a 35% drop. Gold was purchased by many of the central banks around the world over the last 2 or 3 years, almost as a precaution against their own policies of providing easy credit to the banking system. And so Germany, France, Russia, certainly China, were exchanging their dollars for gold, and that helped gold run itself up. There's really no reason to think that that has changed. In fact, it's even more valid. If that was a bona fide reason to buy gold, then people should be still buying gold. But it's not the case. Some of the hedge fund managers, the guy that made the most money on the housing market crash, John Paulson, who was a huge bull on gold last year, has sold half of his gold positions and taken huge losses. A lot of big retirement funds that diversified into gold in the late 2000s, the first decade, have huge losses on their portfolios. And so I think people are licking their wounds who thought that gold was kind of a sure upwardly moving commodity. And the fact is that nothing moves up on a straight line or a hyperbolic curve, which is what, if you look at the price of gold over the last 10, 15 years, that's what it looks like. So I think that there are technical reasons why gold has come down. There's kind of people made short-term bets and got hurt on those, that the central banks have enough gold, and so their buying has stopped. The gold mining companies are in the tank. They pay dividends, unlike gold owning the metal itself, and I think they're probably undervalued now. And so for people that can stomach owning a volatile a mining stock, that they're worth looking at. But you know, the fact that there is no real reported inflation, that the governments have convinced people that the credit that they have created, you know, just by fiat, by themselves, by decisions, that represents real value, has worked. And so as long as confidence is high in the central banks, then gold will languish. For whatever reason, if that changes, whether it's a political event that we can't anticipate in the Mideast or Pakistan or South Korea, any kind of sustained real uptick in economic activity that looks like it will point towards inflation, The expectation on the part of most people is that inflation is all balled up and just waiting to spring out like a jack in the box, and that people have not been able to raise prices unless you're a hospital or I guess a college or a big bank, and so there's all this pent up expectation that at the first sign of prosperity, prices will go up. And so I think you're going to see a great amount of volatility in the price of gold over the next couple of years. Certainly, there's an old saying, don't fight the Fed, which is to say that if the government is creating money, you want to be in the market, because money is going to flow into the market regardless of the underlying economic reality. That was sort of the first point of this talk. And that has been true. The big question is it possible for the Fed to lose control of money because their creation of reserves and reserve requirements for the banks gets overshadowed by the general public's mistrust of what's been going on? And that will be a very scary day indeed if people start doubting the full faith and credit of either the European Central Bank or the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank. And I think it takes a very big event for that to happen, but it's certainly possible. So our strategy has been to create a kind of a hedge package and to buy some vehicles that will operate inversely to the market, especially the junk bond market, which has had a long period of higher prices, primarily because of the easy credit. And to me, the big issue is how long can it go on? How long can the government continue to give out easy credit without a crack in the confidence of the ability to repay those easy credits? And to me, that's worth taking a certain portion of a portfolio and hedging against the day when that happens, because that day will come. When it comes, how it comes, is really impossible to know. See if there's time for one more question before we bring this talk to a close. Any other subjects that pique anyone's interest? All right. Well, with that, then we'll bring the talk to a close. And thank you, people who are listening. And let me know what you think. And for all you listeners listening later, be in touch and join us next time. So thanks again. Bye.
Thanks.
Thanks, Rob.